Okay, kids, here it is, the conversation that I have been desperate to have, because this is a topic that just won't go away and it's flooding everybody's feeds and there's some real misinformation out there. So I want to cut to the bottom of the GLP-1, Mounjaro, Ozempic, menopause supplements, genetics conversation with our special friend, Lindsay Kosh, who is a clinical nutritionist. This is her wheelhouse. And I know there's a lot of questions, there's a lot of overwhelm, and there's also a lot of excitement around this possible breakthrough that we're hearing about in weight loss. And obviously for women over 40, it's a huge issue because it's damn hard to move some of that belly fat that has possibly been building up for the past few years just through perimenopause. And we don't know how to get rid of it. And when we're now seeing all this wonderful footage of people feeling amazing and looking great, there's a lot of questions. And of course, too nervous for me to go to my GP and ask about it. So I'm coming to you, Linz.
And look, it's a huge topic. Like you said, it's pretty much everywhere. You're not going to escape the debate. It's very polarizing. You will see some doctors loving it, some doctors hating it, some naturopaths loving it, some naturopaths using it. So it's really difficult, I think, for the average consumer to try and figure out, do I do it? Do I not do it? There's lots of whispers and conversations. So I think this is really just about getting it all out there, open and talking about it.
And again, the wonderful thing about social media is that there is a lot of information, but yet we don't know where that information is coming from. And we don't know whether these so-called, you know, influencers are being paid. We don't know whether, you know, we talk a lot on the podcast here about Big Pharma being behind some of the most enormous medical myths of all time. So you're not being paid by anyone. You have no connection to any company, pro or against. No. You are just for the science of what these GLP-1s are. And hopefully you can just set some of that straight for us in our own minds to make educated decisions.
Absolutely. And you do have to be a little bit wary and skeptical about where you get information from, just so that you know. Novo Nordics, which is obviously the manufacturer of Ozempic, spent about $27 million just for promotion of this particular medication or drug. So that's promotions with GPs and different medical societies and funding studies through universities and things like that. So we all are now a little bit more aware that there is money behind Big Pharma and the sort of information that we get. But what you first thing need to do is try and find that sort of unbiased position where you're weighing out the pros and the cons. I think that's a really good way to go about any sticky conversation like this, is look at it holistically and figure out who is the right person that this medication might be good for. I see this medication, the reason why it is such a topic of conversation, it is a reflection of our society and where we are at now. The reality is we are in a cardiometabolic inflammatory crisis, particularly in second world countries, maybe not so much in third world countries. But it's a big thing and it's actually a genuine concern. So there wouldn't be as much of a need for this type of drug or medication if the majority of our second world countries don't have this sort of issue. So we do need to do something about it, that's for sure.
Okay, so we know that being overweight can come from many different reasons. You know, we're big on genetic testing here, and there's obviously lots of dynamics going on in everybody's own genetics that will help you process fats and foods better than others. So we're all about getting to, obviously, the core of your own personal health journey. You mentioned before whether it's a drug or a medication. Let's start with the basics. The term GLP-1, what is that?
Yes. Look, it's good that they turned it into a little acronym. Glucagon-like peptide 1. So GLP-1 is a little receptor that we have throughout our body, but primarily in the small intestine, in what we call the L cells, and also in the brain, which of course then indicates that link again that we have with gut-brain axis. They communicate to each other. The important thing to know is this is not like other medications. If I can just take a step back here, the reason why a lot of pharmaceutical medications have such significant side effect profiles is simply because of the mechanism of action of the way they work. So in our body, in our biochemistry, we have little receptor sites and we have compounds, proteins that actually fit inside that receptor site. We'll use the example of things like a statin medication. A statin medication simply holds space in those receptor sites, which is why it causes side effects that are wide-reaching, because that one receptor site isn't just one biochemical pathway. Every receptor site probably influences multiple biochemical pathways. So a statin medication, when it holds space, lowers the production of cholesterol, but we also know it lowers the production of natural coenzyme Q10. So this is the traditional sense of medications: block receptors, downchain issues with side effects.
And that's the same for a headache tablet or anything, isn't it? It's obviously blocking your pain receptors, so you don't have a headache any longer.
Yeah. And then there's a duration that they will last, mm-hmm. and then you have to take that medication again for it to work. Mm-hmm. So about 70 to 80% of medications work that way. This medication is a little bit different. It is technically a peptide. So in the whole biohacking space, people probably would have heard from Dr. Gary Brecka and other ones, BCP-157. There's all this talk about peptide therapy and how effective it has worked. There are people that genuinely get huge benefits. It's obviously not as available here in Australia, but in other countries, they're using this quite a lot. Funnily enough, the FDA in the United States are actually trying to really crack down on peptide interventions. So it works slightly differently. It's not necessarily blocking and holding receptor sites the same way a medication is. It's actually stimulating. It's actually coming in kind of like hormone replacement therapy. So I really want you to think of it as the same line as HRT. We're trying to get in and we're trying to stimulate the same receptors as if that hormone is still there. The GLP-1 agonist medications are kind of doing the same thing, trying to stimulate that pathway. Of course, that is a natural pathway that we can talk about later. There's natural ways to stimulate it, but people are finding it just a very easy strategy. And the reason why people are probably finding such big results is it affects the way our brain receives hunger signals. So if you talk to anyone that has actually been on this medication, the one thing that you will hear from every single person is, I don't have food noise anymore, meaning I don't think about food in any way, shape, or form. It also slows down the speed that food goes through the gastrointestinal tract. And so, of course, that makes you feel fuller for longer. And so inherently, people don't eat as much. And that is, if the simplest version, that is simply how these medications work, is it basically signals to the brain, I don't need any food and I'm really full, so don't put any more in me. So people inherently significantly reduce their caloric intake. Mm-hmm. And of course, they're going to be losing weight as a result of it.
A quick pause for anyone interested in joining our DNA testing program in partnership with Fit Genes, a world-leading genetics company. So many of you have already joined our Fit Genes community. So now, for anyone who hasn't, it's your turn. Get to know your genes with us. When you know your genes and your unique genetic breaks, you can do something about it. For us here at the Aging Project, we've learned it's the best first step in our aging well journey. If you'd like to learn more, visit theagingproject.com and join the Fit Genes waitlist. We'll send you all the details so you can get started. Okay, so for me, I love eating. I have found a joy in dining. Am I going to lose that joy as well? Like, I don't necessarily eat because I'm hungry. I eat because it's breakfast, or I eat because it's lunch, or I eat because I'm going out for dinner. I don't eat because I'm hungry. I know other people do, and again, that comes down to your genetics. But if you are on one of these, I mean, what else do you do with your day?
Look, it's a concern for me, because I truly feel that eating food is a primal joy. You know, when you look at the heart of what causes behavioral adaptations for hunger, is we have these taste buds, and that's kind of like nature's way of rewarding us, of like, oh, this tastes good, so I want you to eat it. But the real driver behaviorally for us to be hungry is it's our body's adaptation to try and pull in nutrients. Mm-hmm. That's really what it's about. So I do have slight concerns that if you don't have that natural drive and that natural sense of hunger, are you going to be meeting your key nutrient targets? Mm-hmm. Like I've said many times, you have 90 essential nutrients you need per day. You can get vitamin D from sunshine. The other 89 nutrients we need to try and manually input into our system for our organ systems and tissues to work. So I think we're still in the early days of the popularity of these drugs. These drugs have actually been around for a very, very, very long time. Mm-hmm. They've just become, I think, mainstream since sort of 2016, 2017, and it just has been ramping up in its popularity. So, okay, so I feel still, like we don't still, have a long
time. You're still eating, but that food is obviously staying longer in your system, therefore you're feeling full for longer. So is your body still...
Yeah.
Extracting the nutrients that it needs, or is it just pushing that food all the way through and out without actually absorbing anything? Does it change the way our digestive system works?
Awesome question. I would say yes. We don't have the long standing data. That's the one thing I was saying, is we're now going to have such a huge population that's going to be on it. Over time, we're eventually going to have the data. Mm-hmm. To see how this is going. At the moment, I think it's still too early, but this is my concern. We have a certain speed and pace that we need food to go through our digestive system for what is called optimal digestion and absorption. So we know that there's an issue when someone comes in that has constipation. Mm-hmm. So if someone is constipated, then that is too slow of a transit time, which can affect all kinds of biochemistry. On the flip side, if you have loose stools and diarrhea, it's too fast of transit time. So either end of the spectrum is slightly concerning when it comes to your body's ability to digest, break down, absorb, and then transport those nutrients in the body. Mm-hmm. So the way my clinical brain works, I'm going, okay, well, we know this medication significantly slows down the speed that your food goes through the system. What is going to be the long-term ramifications? A lot of people do say that, and this is the crazy thing about these medications, 80% of people experience nausea. Mm-hmm. 80% is a huge statistic. Mm-hmm. But again, when you're offering weight loss, they'll be like, I'll put up with nausea. I don't care. They're like, as long as I'm losing the weight. 30% of them can get to the point where they're vomiting. Mm-hmm. There are other rare cases where you're getting gastroparesis, which is basically the paralysis of the digestive system. Keep in mind that when you stop the medication, that stops as well. But during the intake of the medication, we are finding for some people, it's literally stopping the whole process. And there's issues with pancreas as well as vision, as well as even thyroid cancer. So there are concerns here mm-hmm. that I don't think we should take lightly. I think we need to weigh it out. If you are already prone to constipation, I would probably be like, well, you're going to need to have a good strategy. Yeah. You're going to really need to work on nutrition if that's the case.
I would imagine, and this is just speaking to people that I know, that I've had these conversations with, mm-hmm. that the driver is once I get to my goal weight, once I drop a few kilos,
yeah.
then I can maintain. I'll come off it and I'm good. I feel great. So I'm going to want to exercise more. So I'm going to want to eat well because I've had that shift and I know what it feels like to feel good or to fit into my skinny jeans again, whatever it may be. So the coming and going from one of these drugs, I'm going to call them drugs, whether they are or not, medications, drugs, whatever it is, is that a problem?
We don't know yet. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The reality is that we don't know just yet. They were originally made for type 2 diabetes, worked really effectively on that, but we're using them at such broad scale for everyone. I don't think that there's any criticism around the use of these medications of people that are in a really serious metabolic state, people that have got really bad type 2 diabetes, obesity, heart disease. I don't think there's any issue of people going, look, someone who is significantly obese, this type of medication can change their life. Because if you can assist the weight loss in the beginning, they can actually get up and move. Because some people are that heavy that it hurts. They physically cannot get up and exercise and move. So I think there's nuances to this medication. For an everyday person just to drop 5 kilos for a wedding or a party, I'm not sure if we know the long-term ramifications as of yet. I only know one person. I think I must be, obviously I'm on a different circle in my world, but I do know one lady who was on it and, she's 50 something and she has suffered her whole life with eating disorders, mm-hmm. even to the age of 50. And she said to me, and I'm working with her because I try and support her with everything that she does and I offer my side. And she said, I said, are you eating? And she goes, well, and I went, oh no. I said, how many meals are you eating a day? One. So this is my concern. Your question is, they're still eating. I go, are they still eating? Mm-hmm. Are people still eating on these medications? Because without that drive, there's no, you almost probably could go a whole day and forget about it. You don't need to eat. So she was having one meal a day. She was also significantly constipated. So we were talking about pros and cons, but she said to me, she goes, you know, Lindsay, I have to tell you though, I have been plagued my whole entire life by this constant battle in my mind of, I want to eat that, don't eat that. I want to eat that, don't eat that. And she goes, I have to be honest with you. Someone who's been longstanding suffering with disordered eating patterns, she goes, that food noise is completely gone.
Because mm-hmm. she's not even thinking gone. About food
she's
at
like,
all.
I'm free. Yeah. She goes, I'm completely free. And for the 6 months prior, she didn't want to tell me she was on it. And then I started noticing, I'm like, what are you doing? And she's like, okay. And I'm glad that she talked to me about it because I'm like, if you're going to make the choice to be on this medication, the one thing I would say to you is, can I please, please help you do it right? The worst thing I think anyone could ever do is jump on the bandwagon of the trend of this and not realize that there are certain foundational habits that need to be formed. Because if you're going to use it to get from A to B, and like you said, reset your patterns, you have to actually be establishing those patterns while you're on the medication. Mm-hmm. Even the manufacturing themselves, if you look at what they encourage, they are telling you, if you're going to be on this medication, you need to do weights and strength training 4 to 5 times a week, and you need to have adequate levels of protein and good nutrition. Now, this is from the manufacturer of the medication, but I feel like that message is getting missed, that they're telling you themselves that, you know, if this medication is on board, you have to keep your lean muscle. We do know there is cases where people are just on this medication and they're not exercising and they're not eating. That is the wrong way to use it. It is the absolute wrong way to use it. But if you're using the medication, we'll have to talk about dosage too, because there's a lot of research looking at the dosage of it. Then you need to make sure that you have that alongside, so that if you decide, okay, I've done, you know, 6 months or a year of this particular med and I want to come off of it, that you're not going to just go right back to where you were, which is generally the case with any kind of extreme protocol diet or restriction.
Have you heard the news? Our sister platform, You Must Try It, now offers one-on-one health coaching via Zoom with our team of qualified experts. Our store exists to offer you more than our tried and tested products. We want you to age well, and at the foundation of that is your health. Let me share Lou's feedback, one of our recent customers. She wrote, I still can't believe how much we got through in an hour. I was offered the most detailed personal advice I've ever had. I've been talking to all my friends about their health coaching sessions and my experience. The friends that have already had their session couldn't be happier. Thank you, Lou. So if you're struggling with a health issue, perhaps a gut, a thyroid, weight, energy, or sleep issue, or maybe like Lou, you just want to optimize your health, our You Must Try It team of qualified health coaches would love to help you. They can help with everything from blood, hormone, and food sensitivity testing to practical strategies, so you know what to do and buy that is actually going to work. Just go to youmusttryit.com and book your appointment, and let's take action to age well, my friends. Okay, so let's talk about the difference between somebody in their 20s, 30s using this and somebody who's over 40 when our metabolism is changing anyway. We've done a lot of chat here about how perimenopause affects the way that we process food, the way that we burn fat, the way that we should be exercising, the difference in food intake that we should be having to maximize and to work best for our, you know, middle-aged women bodies. This is where it comes in, because obviously strength training is a huge thing for all of us and must be done. Of course, you've got to keep your cardio up as well. We talk a lot about, you know, the supplements like your creatines, of course, having the right amount of proteins. What order you do these in now when you exercise, and again, there's other podcasts you can listen to that we've chatted about that stuff. But for the over 40s, this is going to be a very different situation than men or women in their 20s, 30s.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I feel like if in your 20 and your 30, your biochemistry is still working for you. You have a much better chance with slight changes in habits in lifestyle nutrition that your body's probably going to be quite responsive. So in some ways, I feel like for those population that are younger, it's kind of, it very much is the easy route. If you're going to be like, I'm just going to go on Ozempic or any of these other medications. It does change. That's the one thing I will say is when we do get into sort of that, you know, late 30s into our 40s, we do know that we are genuinely working with biochemical changes in the body. So when we start to lose our hormones and estrogen in particular, that controls a lot of our glucose insulin control, our energy, our metabolism. Generally, by the time we've reached our 40s, we've probably by then had a fair few stressors in life as well. When you're 20s, if you think about it, I was actually chatting to a girlfriend on a walk this morning going, remember those days? You didn't think about anything when you're in your 20s. Like you just didn't. And then now when you're in your 40s, you really just, you weigh out the pros and cons. You go back and forth on just about every little thing. So by the time someone gets into their 40s, cortisol levels probably are going to be a lot higher than when you're in your 20s. Now, cortisol, again, is a very powerful hormone that signals to the body that it's under duress and stress. And if you think of it from a very primal perspective, it makes sense and it's very smart for the body under times of extended stress and duress to hold on to energy. Mm-hmm. And so that's that, again, that visceral fat, that belly fat, sometimes they call it a cortisol belly. We have that factor in there as well. And then of course we have changing levels of insulin control. So I think this is where for some men and women, when we get into this next stage of our life, if we haven't laid some really good solid foundations ahead, it feels like there's some big changes that need to occur in life. I would argue that they're really, really good changes for longevity. So I don't think they're a bad thing, you know, getting out and moving, exercising, endorphins, you'll feel better, mental health. You could go on and on about the benefits of them. Mm-hmm. But I think for some people that maybe have gotten away for most of their life not doing anything, it's like a shock. They're like, whoa, wait a minute, what is happening to my body? You tell me I have to do what now? And I got to think about my food. So I think this is, again, a reflection of society where people are turning to these medications.
But there's also been a lot of positive chat about these medications helping with your heart health, your, you know, your mental health. What do you read into that? Is that true?
Yes, because of the mechanism of action about the way they work. It's a peptide. So the one thing that, we'll go back to the example of one that's probably familiar, BCP-157. So if you have...
Oh, yes, this is very familiar. Rolls off my tongue. Yes.
Yes, sorry. Gary Breck has done a lot to like talk about these things. He's really gotten it out there. You know, if you pull a muscle on a shoulder, really significant injury, and if you're in a country where they do an injection of like peptide therapy, that peptide literally is regenerative. It's not something like taking an ibuprofen while, you know, the medication's in the receptor site, it's working, you don't feel pain, and then it comes back. Mm-hmm. Peptide therapy actually is regenerative. And so that is where you'll see really diehard people advocating for this medication because it is technically peptide as well. And so we do know that it is getting in there and it is actually changing and healing, whether it be heart tissue. There's quite a few benefits from it. Mm-hmm. I know there is naturopath in the United States that's quite a big advocate of it. I think her name is Dr. Tina Moore, and she uses it very differently than a lot of other doctors and naturopaths, which I have to honor that she's deep dived into it. She's really looked at her research, mm-hmm. and she microdoses it. Mm-hmm. So the unfortunate thing is that a lot of these big pharmaceutical companies, they regulate the level of injection because, believe it or not, you can't patent a peptide because a peptide is a naturally occurring substance. You can't claim that you made it. So what these pharmaceutical medications have done is they actually add a little fatty acid ester onto it, and they also have patented the delivery style. Mm-hmm. So that's the only way these pharmaceutical medications can actually get access to it and say, this is mine. So she actually microdoses and compounds on her own using compound pharmacies, which you can obviously find certain practitioners using here in this in Australia and the United States. But I have to honor because when she talks about her clients and the way she uses it, she says the dosages that are standardized are way too much. And I kind of, again, my biochemistry brain, I do find watching over the last 20 years of just watching all the trends, all the things, I feel like humans, as clever as we are, we tend to err on the side of when we find something that we think is a miracle, whatever, we like to throw as much of as we can at the human body. I'm like, more is better. More is better. And I'm like, that's not how the body works. Case in point is iron. A lot of iron supplements are about 100 milligram doses at one hit. There's no food that's that high. So the body actually does a secondary mucosal blocking and it just traps it and it goes out through fecal route. So more is not always better. And in the case of these GLP-1 agonist medications, she's kind of revolutionizing them and doing them at much, much less doses. And she's finding that there are not the associated side effects as a result of it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what I was saying, is we have to have the conversation about dosage as well. So if you go to a GP and you're talking about this medication, I would ask those questions. And that's what this podcast is really important about, is people may not even be aware that the dosage that are standardized is probably far too much. They're even talking about I think there's a study at the moment that's talking about tripling the dose that they're currently using. And I'm going, no, don't do that.
No, well, again, there has been some prolific influencers that have, talked quite heavily about their usage and saying that they were buying it black market style, I suppose. And it was the dosage for a, 100 kilo man, for example, and they're a 60 kilo woman, and finding obviously those side effects just so horrendous that they would stop using it after a period of time. But obviously then working out their own dosage. Again, the fact that they are so readily available now, as you say, going down a controlled route with support and your GP's knowledge and all those things is definitely a way to go. And and what we're here to do is provide you with just a broader scale of information that isn't influenced either way by anything. So you're saying if you are to consider it, then obviously having a very considered nutrition plan is vital, along with your usage.
I feel like in an ideal world where these medications were assessed, whether you are a person that genuinely needs it, this is the way I go. And it's the same approach that when people ask me about, HRT replacement, all that, I say, look, I don't think you can have one blank statement or approach for every person. You have to look at each person and client that's in front of you. But what I would say is lay the foundations first. It's the same advice I give to women with hormone issues. I want you to tick all the boxes when it comes to nutrition and protein and sleep and movement and stress management. Tick all the boxes first. Mm-hmm. And if you still find yourself suffering to the point where your day-to-day existence is really uncomfortable, that's the time that you start to look into what other alternatives do I have. I would say the same argument needs to come to these medications as well. There are so many other benefits from a longevity perspective for you doing the real work. I find sometimes there's no shortcuts in life, and metabolically underneath the surface, you need to be improving your metabolic health so that when that medication comes off, you're left with better foundations than what you started with. So I feel in an ideal world, a GP would regulate these medications, and it would be a requirement that they have to participate in obviously strength training, gym memberships, regularly meet with a dietitian, a clinical nutritionist, a naturopath, whoever it might be, to be able to support them alongside using this medication. I think if I could paint a perfect picture, that's what it would definitely be like.
Okay. We speak about skinny fat, right? You might look skinny on the outside, but you've still got visceral fat, which is the fat that sits around your organs and is dangerous for long-term health and disease. When you are losing weight through one of these options, but you're not doing any regular exercise or particularly weightlifting and looking after your proteins and nutrition, you can be skinny fat.
100%. Yep. Yeah. Look, it tends to really be helpful when it comes to losing intra-abdominal visceral weight, which we do know metabolically active sends out inflammation. So that is definitely a type of weight you don't want to ignore. And that's, we talk a lot about that in our Bye Bye Belly Fat program, that, yep, we need to address it. It's not just about vanity, it's about health. But the reality is if you significantly lose your fat mass alongside with your lean muscle mass and stop the medication, you're actually in far worse of a situation, because lean muscle is your organ of longevity, and lean muscle metabolically is what keeps you as healthy as you possibly can. When we eat food, so when we eat protein and carbs, not so much fats, obviously with the reduced level of glucose and insulin that fats release into the body, as long as they're good fats. But when we eat protein and carbohydrates, our body is trying to convert that into glucose, because glucose is the body's main fuel source. But once that molecule of glucose gets into the bloodstream, it cannot stay there, because high blood sugar is very damaging to the body. So this is where insulin comes in and starts to signal receptors to start pulling glucose into cells, organs, and tissues. Now, I say to women all the time, to try and back up my motivation for them to find a love for the gym or weights, which they probably never have, is I said, let me explain to you the why of why I want you to do weights. And when I explain to them, they're very motivated. I go, your muscle is your body's preferred storage site for glucose. So when we have glucose coming in and insulin comes in, goes, okay, let's put this for storage somewhere, it's going to try and put it into lean muscle in the form of muscle glycogen. That's its preferred route. It's like, yep, yeah, we'll stick it in the muscle. And that makes sense, so that when you have activity and movement, you've got energy in those muscles to fire. If we start losing our lean muscle mass, which can happen if you don't do these medications right, then off the back of getting off of it, where's your body then going to store its glucose? It changes its biochemical pathway and runs it through the liver, and it starts to accumulate more visceral adiposity and weight. So that's what I was saying, is muscle is so important for you. And I just don't think we understand the mechanism of why. And so it's not just about how you look or fit in your jeans. Oh, that's just a great side bonus when you feel good about your body. It's more about, where is your body going to store its energy? And that's where it's tied into metabolic health. So we don't want to be losing muscle for any reason, ever.
Lindsay, you are so good at breaking things down and making them sound simple. And I know that, and that you have for us for years made all of this very digestible and achievable. I think what our message is here is, if you are considering or are already going down one of these routes with a GLP-1, that make sure that it is monitored and controlled and sanctioned, I suppose, by your healthcare professional. We're going to take a little break, and we're going to come back and talk about how our body can do this on its own, just with perhaps a little bit more effort than an injection in the bum. So stay with us. Your body can do this on its own. It's going to take a little bit more work on your part, but obviously a lot more achievable for long-term health results and, of course, your own longevity. So thank you, Linz. We'll check back in a moment, and you can nerd out on us all you like with more biochemistry in just a sec. As always, the Aging Project podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes. Always seek medical advice from a qualified practitioner.